Hello, goeiemiddag, sangbonan. Those are about 3 out of the 11 official languages in South Africa that we use to greet people. It's another day and another podcast. I'm joined, as always, by the wonderfully bearded Gareth Woods. What's happening, Gareth?
Yeah, all good, though. Nice. Like the intro, like the cultural diversity you're bringing now. 3 languages. The rest purchased on DLC later.
Yeah, I had more swimming around in my head, and I just couldn't vocalize them when the pressure was on. This is my, second or third time trying to introduce the pod? Shit, did I introduce myself?
First time this season as well.
My name is Tim Lester, for those who are curious. It is episode 2, season 2, of the Game of the Gaming Guru podcast.
I heard Game Boot. The Game Boot show.
Of the Game Boot. And yeah, man, to kick it off, what you been up to?
Yeah, it's been another week in lockdown, another week in paradise. Here in Joburg, it is crazy cold. Getting me ready for those Canadian winters, I think. Although I believe Cape Town is much of the same.
Yeah, very cold. Storming up to the 10th degree. I love it when Cape Town actually lives up to its, you know, Cape of Storms namesake. Mm. It really, you know, you can really resign yourself to the coziness, and I'm digging it. I've been playing a lot of Prey this week. Oh, yeah. I can't believe how hard I slept on that game when it came out. There were just so many other things happening. I didn't give it a chance, but it had been sitting on my shelf for the longest time. And I put it in a couple of weeks ago. Well, yeah, like last week. And I'm just having such a blast. Like, I've noticed that whenever I talk to someone about the game, the things that I'm saying is it's usually like glowing praise for, I don't know, its music, its atmosphere, its abilities, combat system, its exploration, its story. I noticed that the game would do this thing where as soon as you sort of finish off a quest, it plays like this little musical interlude that sounds really hopeful and relaxing and happy, and it creates this contrast to all those moments of like tension and anxiety and paranoia that the game kind of like puts you in and keeps you there. And I always find like this, you know, breath of fresh air, like kind of wash over me, and I get this false sense of safety, and then something else like jumps out and rocks my world. So
yeah,
really digging that.
Yeah, it was good. I think you were right that it seemed to come out at a time when there was just better things coming. I can't remember at the time, but I do remember playing it just enough to do the review and then not really touching it because I had so much other stuff to kind of get through, which, you know, sometimes is, you know, no fault on the developer because, you know, they might launch what is essentially a narrative-driven first-person shooter in what calendar-wise looks like, oh, this is a great spot for launching games, you know, to other first-person shooter fans. But in the meantime, they're launching, you know, let's say the same week as, you know, a big title RPG game, which, you know, they're not really appealing to the same market, but unfortunately, from a review point of view, it's like, okay, God, got to get this done and then jump onto the next thing. But yeah, I still have it. Certainly, if I ever get into the going through my backlog or get bored or whatever, something I'd look at. Have you finished it yet?
Haven't finished it yet. I'm unsure about like how far into the game I am, although I have clocked around like 20 odd hours so far. But I know that I came across one of the possible endings. There's like an escape pod towards the top of Talos 1. And you can just get in it and fly away. And that could be one of your endings. And you can get there like pretty quickly, actually.
So that's the speedrun ending kind of thing.
Yeah, looks like it. But there's a lot more going on the ship. And I'm just digging, exploring it, and figuring out how everything connects. And, you know, working out my escape routes and... Awesome. Turning into coffee mugs and good vibe.
I remember that much. That was pretty fun. Turning into random objects too. Surprise, guys. Myself, I've been playing a lot of mixing it between Hearthstone and Ghost of Tsushima, which it's unfortunate this podcast is going to land 2 days before embargo rises. So I'll have to give my full thoughts next week. But all in all, enjoying it. It's big. I think I've clocked in about 20, maybe 25 hours.
Wow.
Doing just act one. And, you know, let's assume there's 3 acts. If I look at how much of the map I've explored in the normal kind of 3-act narrative. And it's Yeah, it's big. To be fair, I haven't like mainlined the quest. I chatted to another reviewer and he finished the entire game, but just mainlining the main story in about 30 hours. So similar to kind of The Last of Us and all that. Which for me, I always feel with a narrative driven game is a decent length before it starts getting a bit paddy, if you know what I mean. Like I will say, as much as I enjoyed Last of Us, it did feel like you could have shaved maybe 3 to 4 hours off it just to make it a bit tighter.
You're not the first person that I've heard say
that. It started feeling a lot like when you watch Lord of the Rings, like the final bit, and you're like, the movie could end here. Wait, the movie could end here. The movie's going to end here. Okay, they're going on a boat now. It'll end here. They go, oh, back to the Shire here. It's like there are multiple points where, you know, from cliffhangery to like, okay, overexposed closure levels, like it could have dropped off at any point. And it felt like that in the game. Like there were points where, I don't know, I had this, like it yearned back to feelings I had when I played God of War, where you're finishing up and you go, if it stopped here, it would be a cliffhanger, but you would feel content in terms of the story having gone far enough and enough gameplay being played. And then it went a little bit further, and then they do actually drop a little bit of a cliffhanger with the whole, you know, you find out about, you know, Loki slash Atreus and that little Thor appearance and all that. And you go, cool, rad, I've played enough. The story is encapsulated and done, but I'm ready to kind of kick off for the next one. We're almost told that there will be more God of the War based on the way that that game ends. Whereas Last of Us, the way it ends, you know, without spoiling it, I'll say that it could end right there. There doesn't have to be a part three. There could, but they would have to kind of have to unpick some of the threads that it created. Yeah.
So if you can't say anything about Ghost of Tsushima, can you sort of like sum up your experience so far in kind of like three descriptive-ish words?
I will say that the it does branch quite well between open world and main story, which I think a lot of games that try and play both parts struggle with. I think of like Assassin's Creed and Batman, they struggle with that a little bit because of the idea of urgency on the main quest versus, you know, the desire to just do your own thing in an open world, which in all honesty is something I have complained about before in open world games. I remember with Batman, I really got kind of like, I suppose, bleak about the fact that you have Scarecrow shouting at, you know, Batman, you've got 2 hours till the gas is released, whatever, and you're running around, you know, solving Riddler puzzles like some kid with ADD in that. So it's like, you know, how important is this main quest? And especially games that have gone from linear into open world, like the Tomb Raider games, for example. I think I said before, like the Nazis are 2 hours away from capturing, you know, the cradle of mankind or whatever it is they need to you know, bring apart another 1,000-year Reich. And, you know, some villager goes, there's a bear in that cave, and if you get rid of the bear, I'll give you the sniper rifle that I have for some reason. You know, I have this massive sniper rifle because I'm, you know, a villager living in twigs and berries, but sure. And so off you go killing bears for a sniper rifle when the Nazis
If you're me, I'd be like, okay, thanks, villager. I'm going to go, like, find all 50 like hidden totems in this area for my achievement. Exactly. See you next year, mate.
100%. So yeah. I think it does that quite well. That being said, there are a lot of things to like keep you busy. So you've got the main quest, and then there's, you know, kind of, I won't say formulaic, but like different types of, you know, quests that they fill the side quests with. So it's a typical like, in this one, spy on someone, you know, don't let them see you as, you know, you follow them to somewhere. In another one, it's like free hostages. So basically get into a camp and kill the bad guys without, you know, them being alerted, and therefore they'll kill the hostages. It's, you know, the kind of things you've gotten used to from these sort of one-man army, you know, stealth type games. The fighting is really good. It's pretty fun, pretty fluid. At first you get a little bit, it's a bit janky because you have to control the camera. So if you played Dark Souls type right. games where you can lock the camera onto someone, fight who's your main target, switch between targets.
Oh, I see.
You can be attacked at any direction, which if you're not in control of your camera, I think someone who's, you know, the one way you can tell like a new player is like they're often in control of their character, but they're not in control of their camera. It's almost like you can see their brain switching between the two. It's like, yeah, fix my camera to where I want it to be, then move my character. There's not this like doing both at the same time. So I think if you're in that space, you know, it might be a bit difficult. I'm not sure if there are accessibility options and like easier game options. I'm playing it on normal difficulty, but you know, maybe on the easier difficulties there's an action camera or a locked camera, which might help you. Yeah, and then the one thing I will say is it does feel like you can unlock a lot of your character very early, which I think some people like and some people don't like. So if you're stuck on the main quest, you can go do a lot of side quests, level up. It kind of got that Witcher feel to it,
right?
You know, where you can go, if you're stuck on a main quest and you just can't get through, you can go do side quests, level up, get your gear better, and then the main quests are a bit easier. So I think without spoiling it too much, that's my feeling. I think it's going to probably come out with pretty high reviews. It's load times are good, graphics are stunning, there's an awesome photo mode.
Wow.
I will say in the beginning I was a little bit unimpressed by the character models, but that's that unfortunately is a burden of open world games. So because you can, there are so many different points of attack, so the way you jump onto a cliff or the way your horse goes over like a bush or something, you're going to eventually get that angle that your horse looks a bit janky because he's jumping over, you know, he's doing a massive, you know, steeplechase hurdle type leap over essentially a twig, because those sort of instances will happen. Whereas on the more linear games, in fact, you know, the most recent game I played was Last of Us, it's a lot more linear. So your way of interacting with certain things is way, you know, less varied and therefore far more precise. And so you get far fewer of those weird interactions. So yeah, there are a couple of those, but not to the point where you go, you know, some open world games are crazy broken because of that, you know, where your characters are, and what's the classic with guards, you know, you've alerted them and then like you've killed their buddy right next to them and they're just like standing there not doing anything. I haven't had any of those experiences.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Looking forward to like a more fleshed out review.
And
I'm also looking forward to getting my hands in it and jumping into it. There's been a lot of hype around the release and I think a lot of it just has to do with the setting. Like we haven't actually seen a game like this in this setting, you know, open world RPG feel. The closest that kind of came to it was maybe Sekiro, but that's, you know, in a whole league of its own. Anyway, do you want to get into the fish dicks?
Yeah, let's do it.
We got some fish dicks for the week.
Do you like fish dicks?
Love them. You're a gay fish. No, I'm not.
Okay, so fish dicks for the week. We have, we're going to be looking at Ubisoft Forward, which is kind of like their, what would have been Ubisoft's E3 showcase for this year. They did, they jumped on that live stream bandwagon in the same vein as Sony and EA for their big press this year. That was on Sunday the 12th. And got a couple of really, couple of big updates to some games that we knew were coming, some games we didn't. Kind of the big one for me was the announcement of a trailer for Far Cry 6. Looks like Ubisoft were, you know, went back to the drawing board and were like, you know what makes Far Cry games really cool? A really cool villain. So they went and got the most villainous villain of all, Giancarlo Esposito from Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, Mandalorian. That guy is just, his CV just screams, it just says villain on it. That's all it says, you know?
I've got good bad guyness.
He's playing the main villain, El Presidente, and it looks like this game is taking place on a fictional island of Yara, city of Esperanzo. It has this sort of,
like a 90, Cuban sort of
Cuban influenced Civil War type vibe. The biggest modification to the gameplay loop is that you can now choose the gender of your playable character. I don't think you could do that before in any of their previous games.
You couldn't. I was just thinking of Far Cry 5 if you're allowed to, but no.
So you play as Danny Rojas, who's a guerrilla fighter, and that can either be a male or female character.
Because
so,
Danny can be a girl's name.
Exactly. So I'm kind of hyped for that. I had a good time with Far Cry 5, even though there was a lot of, you know, controversy around that game. What I do think is that the setting for this one just like grips me a lot more. There's something about, like, maybe it's because I watch too much American news or consume too much of it, but like I feel so inundated with that type of like setting, those accents, those story beats, those personalities, and it got a bit overbearing at times in Far Cry 5. So I like that they're taking a departure back to somewhere a bit more exotic, you know, which kind of like made previous Far Cry games feel more alive and exciting to explore.
Yeah, I worry that they haven't gone back to the proper, you know, in the sticks kind of feel though. I mean, I enjoyed Far Cry 5, but I certainly enjoyed more the wilderness aspects of the previous ones, you know, like you've you know, the savannas of Africa and the islands of Thailand and, you know, the mountains of India, or, you know, like Indian themed, I guess, in Kirat or whatever it was called. But, you know, the other one was a kind of, I don't know the area of America, but they're sort of like Montana, Wyoming sort of area, you know, like just
kind of like
fields,
Midwest
fields and lakes and mountains.
Cow
stuff.
Pastures
like,
and shit,
I just, it was okay. I think the thing that pushed that game for me to be more enjoyable than the setting was the characters. Like, I thought the cult thing was great, and, you know, the different seed characters were awesome. But I mean, let's be honest, Far Cry has lent on its villainous credentials pretty much from like Far Cry 2 onwards.
Yeah. So that one looks like it's going to be a lot of hype. Then we got some more, and release date, that would be February 18th, 2021. So we're looking at Q1 of next year.
Yeah, and that's the next big one, Far Cry window. They tend to like enjoy that early year, beginning of the year kind of launched window.
So the next big one, I really like this, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, due out on November 17th. And they had a story trailer that came out a couple months ago, and in this Ubisoft Forward, they were showing some gameplay. Still in the same vein of like their Assassin's Creed Origins model, which kind of like revamped a lot of their systems, made it more RPG based, and they're looking to kind of double down on that by augmenting it slightly and building on top of what they had then with what was the other one? Odyssey,
yeah.
So this one, combat changes. There's a lot of dual wielding. They've introduced a stun system, and a lot of the combat is animation based. So, you know, you'd hit your animation, wait for it to finish, and cancel other people's animations, interrupt them.
Yeah, so very Souls based.
Exactly. You're not just spamming and I felt that a bit in... Yes, exactly. So I felt that a bit in Origins and Odyssey as well, and looks like they're doubling down on that. And bringing back more of their seafaring flavor to the game with, you know, these Viking-themed raids. So you'd start off in kind of this territorial, feudal, like Viking land, and put together your crew, get on your ship and sail over to England, where you're going to, you know, fuck up some of those Christians. Yeah. Have a good time. I'm into it. I've been watching a lot of The Last Kingdom, and I dig it. Just this whole setting, I'm into.
Yeah, I love the setting. I'm certainly more intrigued by this than I was with like the Egyptian vibe. My suggestions for AC in general, if they could just focus far more on the less on the animus stuff. I really find that stuff so boring. Like every time you're forced into that kind of walk around, ask questions about the animus and the, you know, the whole behind the scenes tech stuff, I just like, can we skip that and just, you know, enjoy the setting that you're in? But the other thing is, I wish they would just like I know we've kind of spoken about it already, but less padding. I found like Assassin's Creed is one of the worst culprits of just like padding a game. You know, the a lot of people I've seen have like, I think they jumped into Odyssey recently because of on a Steam special and all that. And so, you know, getting to the point that they quite far in or finishing and they're talking about 130 hours, 200 hours. And I'm just like, that story can be done in like 40. And that even that's a lot of padding. I just wish the story was tighter and the experience was, you know, tighter as opposed to just like going around doing fetch quests and collecting feathers and that sort of stuff. So I'm interested to see, you know, how they manage that. And the other thing is, I don't know if the genre has started leaning more towards it since it's going into kind of more mythological eras, but like I personally enjoy fighting like the beasts and minions and those sort of things as opposed to like just another human character followed by another
gods.
Human character, 100%. So I know Origins did some of that stuff with like the DLC stuff that you could go into, like
that was pretty cool. I actually really appreciated and enjoyed a lot of the extra DLC stuff that they had to offer in Origins. 100% agree with you, the animus stuff sort of like outstayed its welcome in terms of like the formula of Assassin's Creed games have like grown and changed, and they've managed to like hang on to this sort of vestigial organ that doesn't serve much of a purpose anymore in the current in its current model.
Yeah, great analogy. And it's like just this appendix like, that's nothing except, you know, bring it down.
It just has less and less value the further you go into the franchise.
Yeah.
Where it started off as a vehicle in order to explore these, you know, ancient civilizations and locations, now is kind of like an unwanted detour, like you're stopping off so someone can take a piss before you like, you know, carry on your journey.
But the weird thing was that like it you say it's a vehicle for the exploration of the past, but I mean narratively I don't think it added that much. Like it's this idea of going, we need a reason for you to have gone back in time and to follow this like brotherhood of assassins. You're going, yeah, cool, so why does it have to be this futuristic VR thing that we're like going back in time because of, you know, key DNA of certain people who can, it's like, why don't you just tell the story as if, and here we are 5,000 years ago, you know,
because Ezio Auditore.
Exactly.
Because that's
I'm interested, but I will say that I've certainly fallen out of favor with AC probably since Black Flag was the last one I really enjoyed.
Okay, and then so the next big one was Watch Dogs Legion.
Yeah.
I watched like they had a really cool conceptual short film that was made kind of based on the game, which I found a little misleading because I thought maybe this was like when I caught it, I thought, whoa, is this in game?
Nah.
Yeah. But I liked it overall. I think the main draw from this one is that basically any NPC is playable. And the game's story is tailored to which of these NPCs you decide to recruit into your team. So you meet an NPC, recruit NPC, you can play as that NPC, and their story develops and influences the broader narrative that you're following. So it's kind of like a tailor your own adventure based on who you recruit.
Yeah, and so there are like potentially 50 different endings or routes to the end based on who you choose.
And I heard that like they showcase different scenes with various with multiple different characters in those scenes and how the scenes change depending on who's in your team. And for me that's like, okay, that is a lot of voice work. That is a lot of work for editorial on like branching narratives, like to start with are a joke. They must have done a lot of voice work for this game in order to create all these different branching narratives, much of which you probably won't see in your first playthrough. So it's like, you know, like 50 to 60, 70% of the dialogue options you're just not going to come across.
Yeah, just based it might be a lot like how Warner Brothers did it with Shadow of Mordor, with like the bajillion different... you know, orcs and goblins and trolls and stuff that you can recruit, and how they all have different personality types and, you know, strengths and weaknesses and that sort of stuff, like as a starting base. So it's kind of procedurally generated in that sense. So you know, there are 40 different heads and 12 different torsos and all that sort of stuff to make up your character. And then with that, there are, you know, procedurally generated strengths and weaknesses, backstories, abilities and that. And so it's not that they are limitless, but they are, you know, certainly highly varied based on that.
Yeah. So for me, kind of like what stands out the most going through sort of like these biggest announcements, Watch Dogs Legion, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and Far Cry 6, we're seeing, it feels like each of them is a bit more distinct than, let's say, the previous generation of like of Ubisoft offerings,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that
yeah.
Like Far Cry 6, Assassin's Creed, Odyssey, Origins, whatever, Watch Dogs 1 and 2, everything sort of started to feel a bit ubiquitous. They were borrowing a lot of systems from each other. And then, you know, Ghost Recon Breakpoint comes out and just like absolutely bombs.
Because
and
it's all those
Ubisoft
things
does...
mesh into one without being standalone enough. You
exactly.
Know, it felt like a
and,
game
yeah,
created by committee
yeah.
type thing, you know?
Exactly. And it looks like after that happened, they kind of, I think they pushed back a couple of their release dates. They went back to the drawing board of a couple of these games to try and like differentiate them more and make each game feel more like its own game.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to see that a lot of the kind of like the main, you know, hooks or loops or threads that are going through these various games are quite distinct from one another.
Yeah.
You know,
except
like Watch Dogs Legion.
You will always climb a tall building
like,
to...
Yeah.
You'll
yes,
always come to discover the new area. Like that's.
Yeah. The one thing that kind of like did, I felt was a bit aw when I saw the Assassin's Creed Valhalla, they're bringing back that like your OP drone Sparrowhawk vibe.
Okay.
And I'm like, guys, does it have to be a bird in every game that you use as your thing? You know, I thought,
you know, it's us.
You know,
Ubisoft.
I'd be keen for like if Assassin's Creed Valhalla had like a wolf or something, or like a fucking big old shaggy dog, you know, that you can use for scouting and tagging enemies and shit instead of the
we the spent
board,
the money the researching the hawk technology. We're going to you know, sweat that asset for 10 or so more years and then, you know,
there we
migrate
go
from a hawk to a drone.
But yeah, so I do feel like these games feel more distinct than the ones that came before them. And
yeah.
I think there was a considerable effort that was put in place to try and, you know, make that happen.
Mm. It feels as well like just with game development, there is this need to have strong kind of products in very distinct and separate genres. Because the idea that someone... I think becomes a developer fan as opposed to a game or genre fan is becoming more and more distinct. You know, like I think a bad example of this is like how we can become a Blizzard fan. And I've pretty much played every single Blizzard game. There are some I like more and there's some I like less, but I played them all because everything Blizzard puts out, I think is, you know, amazing to, you know, a certain degree.
Yeah.
But they have now definitely moved into a space of going, we have an RPG, we have a, you know, an MMORPG, we have a card game, we have a shooter, we have a team-based, you know, it's like they make sure they have a property in each one of those spaces so that they can provide you with at least one service. So you are a Blizzard customer through at least one of their IPs, as opposed to going, we're going to make... Stark, that's why, like, let's be honest, the death of Warcraft as a game, as an RTS, because we have Starcraft and Warcraft. Let's get rid of Warcraft. Let's use the property and move it into the MMO space, move it into the card space. But I don't see us ever having another Warcraft RTS
like
game.
RTS, yeah.
Because, I mean, for one, the RTS is not a super popular genre, but that's Starcraft space. And that's maybe why Starcraft never moved into the... You know, at one stage, Ghosts was an opportunity. It's like a third-person shooter because they're going, cool, StarCraft needs to stand alone as an RTS brand. If we launch something, it will be something else. You know, it will not... I mean, at one stage, Overwatch was going to be called Titans or something, and that was going to be an MMO. But once again, why create your competitor to Warcraft? Like, have something distinct. And so I think that's what you're seeing here with Ubisoft is you're going, like, Assassin's Creed, Far Cry... what they do with Rainbow Six Siege, all this, these games need to be distinct and standalone by themselves. Yes, they might borrow some tech, like, you know, jumping off the tallest building to discover things, but you know, that's more shared in the back end as opposed to like the marketing and brand identity. These brands all need to stand alone. And
and that kind of like that theme sort of plays out with like the other mentions from Ubisoft's convention, where they mentioned Brawlhalla, which is a new mobile game, which is like a Smash Bros style platform arena brawler.
It's good fun. I played it
on Steam. Tom Clancy's Elite Squad, another mobile hero shooter, Overwatch type vibe, and Hyperscape Story, which is sort of their free to play battle royale. So, you know, they got a battle royale that's covering that bench. They've got their, you know, Overwatch type hero shooter, and they've got their brawler, which would no doubt also cover the Switch market. And covering all those bases, but then still having their main IPs coming through.
I think the one damage potentially that this stuff can do is you start having the Blizzard, Diablo, what's it called? Diablo Unlimited, what is it? The mobile,
Immortal,
that was it. Because that feels like a genre-based decision first. You know what I mean?
Right.
As in like, we need a genre, we need a game in this genre. What genre is that? Mobile, no, whatever, action looter shooter type things. Cool. Can we create a brand new IP? Or can we migrate one of our other IPs into that space? As opposed to going like, cool, we don't need to be in every, as I say that, my brain ticks over. It's like, yes, because Activision is and owns King, and King are, you know, for lack of a better word, kings in the mobile sector. And so there's lots of learnings and stuff they can steal from there. So, I mean, that's probably what's guided that decision. But I think you will see more and more the big studios, the EAs, the Activisions, the Ubisofts and the like, going, almost doing a genre checklist, going, cool, do we have a battle royale? No, we don't. Okay, cool, let's create one. Do we have a card game? No, okay, let's create one. Because you've got to be in every single, you got to fight on every front almost.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, as you were going through that, to that point, I was trying to think of like a good segue that I could like bounce off of
another discussion. I just want to add then, think of what Riot's doing. It dawned on me again. It was like, Riot are, you know, they have their obviously League of Legends, so they've got them over. They've brought out Valorant now. That's their you know, symmetrical team shooter or whatever. Then you've got they brought Legends of Runeterra, which is their card game. They brought Teamfight Tactics, which is their auto battler or chess, whatever they call it, auto chess type thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like they've got a fighting game plan. You know what I mean? That's the same thing of like be in every genre.
Yeah, getting a touch point in every genre.
Yeah.
Which one could argue is a way to dilute the market of a game that's like dominated in that genre. So you'll check like how Fortnite kind of took over the battle royale, and everyone started releasing these free-to-play battle royales, and regardless of how popular or less popular they are, what they're really doing is just taking eyeballs away from the one mega conglomerate who's like, you know, there's space to see space to flood this market so that consumers don't know which one to pick.
Yeah.
Then they won't be spending all their time in Fortnite.
With obviously, I don't have any kind of research to back it up, but I think what you're going to find is that people are genre fans more than they are like studio fans. So you're going to have like someone is a MOBA fan, and so they play League of Legends and Dota and whatever MOBAs there are. Or I'm a first person shooter fan, and so they play Overwatch and Counter-Strike and COD. And I think that's probably what the research is showing, is that people don't play like multiple different titles across different genres in general. You know, I'm a strategy guy. I play strategy games. And so that's why every studio is going, we need a strategy game to compete in each of those markets. But
I think a lot of the strategy also is around like the way that people play these online games, right? Like I was playing Dota because all my friends were playing Dota.
Yeah. If your friends were LOL players, then you probably wouldn't play Dota.
Exactly. I'm not going to be solo queuing by myself in Dota and all my friends are, you know, out in League of Legends. In fact, I switched over to LOL you know, for a while, because everyone switched away from like the War 3 client for a couple of years. But as soon as Dota 2 came back, everyone is back in. So it's a way of breaking up players, breaking up these monopolies that certain devs have over various genres.
Cool. So in lieu of a segue, I think one of the things we want to talk about after the fish sticks was just a lot of time has passed since we got to chat. And I think one of the big things that landed in gaming during our pandemic enforced hiatus was The Last of Us, kind of the news bomb that it was. And I mean, we don't want to go into did you like it or didn't you like it, I really and people's thoughts on, you know, woman female body types and all that. Like, there's so many discussion points on Last of Us, like, we don't want to jump in that. I think the thing that was the most interesting for me personally was, having played the game, enjoyed it, for me it was a 10 out of 10. Not that I think it's a perfect game, but for me it's one of those, like, would I recommend this to anyone? Yes, it's it is the best game I've played since God of War, in the sense of, like, how highly would I recommend that someone plays this? So for me, it was a 10. I do see the shortcomings. It's weird. Even as a 10, it's not as good as Last of Us 1. So you might think, oh, well, then clearly it's a 9.9 or whatever. I would still recommend this 10 out of 10 times to every single person who has access to play the game. But that being said, the reaction that people have had, so I mean, the review bombs, the death threats to not only like the developers, but like people who voice act. And let's be honest, voice actors get a script. It's like, they
get a job.
Yeah, say this. It's not like, cool, what do you think the character would do in the space? Oh, I think they would, you know, spoiler alert, kill Joel. No, Joel is dying, react. Like, this, not even react. These are the lines you have to say, you know?
You know, I wasn't actually sure if we were going to, like, go through the section with, like, spoilers or not. I guess
for me,
spoiler alert, there's
a
spoiler. Spoiler alert, there's a spoiler alert. There's that one big thing that happens that one character does. And I know the spoilers. I kind of, you know, I haven't played the game yet, but it's difficult for me to avoid the news cycle because of, you know, the pod. And I like to stay on top of these things. I also like spoilers because, in fact, with these types of stories where there's something that's quite divisive, I would like to get my take on it before I actually, so I go in primed. I go in like emotionally primed for the experience. I've done this with like several properties that I care about a lot because I generally don't like surprises.
Oh yeah.
But then also I feel like the blow is kind of like softened a bit because there's a part of me that has a sense of acceptance for like what's about to happen. Yeah. And I can move over from that and not have that kind of like cloud the way I think about the rest of the experience of the game.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I like to be surprised. I like to be taken on the journey that the director wants me to go on, which is, I think, why I prefer linear games in general to open world games. And in a weird way, looking at some of the feedback and the backlash of The Last of Us 2 has received, I feel like a lot of it is this entitlement to a property, as if like, these are my characters and I can't believe you did X with Y and killed, you know, this person or had them done dirty by XYZ. It's like, wow, this sounds like the most weird algebra question I've ever heard of. But it's this idea that like, the director has written a story and, you know, in a medium like television or movies, whatever, you just go, you know, believable or unbelievable decision, good or bad. You don't go like, no, that's not how they should have done it. And you, I mean, guys do that, but there's not the same backlash. I feel like in gaming, we feel like we own the characters because we're the ones who have to push them through the story. And in a weird way, I know this is starting to sound like open world bashing the podcast, but it's like, it feels like the entitlement, a lot of it comes from the fact that you go, we've given you so many endings and you can play it however you want. And now suddenly you're given a game where like, this is a story. This
is
what
the
happens.
Ending.
This is the ending. It's not, oh, you got the good ending or the bad ending. Like even a Dark Souls or Sekiro gives you like three endings, you know, that you can accomplish one or the other. This is the ending that the directors wanted. Like, play it. And I remember, for example, like there's a moment where Ellie's going on a like rampage of you know, kind of revenge. And there's a moment where you're interrogating someone and you're kind of beating them to death with a lead pipe. And I'm going, it's like one of those like press square to continue. And like, I don't want to. It feels like I'm being forced to watch like murder porn or torture porn sort of thing. And you're going like, I honestly got up, got something to drink, came back thinking it might be one of those like, you know, Far Cry type things that if you leave it for long enough, then the, you know, the thing ends and you move on. You know, you've taken the pacifist route. Nope. There she is, just sitting there, breathing heavily, about to swing that lead pipe, just waiting for you to press square. And you realize that like you're in control, but you're not in control. It's almost like poetically what the characters are going through. You know, it's once right. You start on this journey of revenge, you've made the decision. There's you can say, are there moments for you to back out or change, but like it's almost like how the characters feel out of control. Like they're going like, she's on this warpath, on this pursuit of revenge. And even though you might feel like, stop, that's enough. Like, don't do it anymore. Like the decision's done. This is an on rails decision. Like there's no backing out. And so I think, you know, maybe we've gotten a little bit like possessive. It harkens definitely back to like Mass Effect 3 and Jeepers, civil actions against BioWare to like redo, you know, either to like declare as not canon or to like remove Mass Effect 3's ending. You know, it's ridiculous stuff like that.
Yeah, and didn't Mass Effect, I mean, BioWare actually, they updated the ending, didn't they? They added like a DLC that augmented the ending to kind of like quell the crowd. But I remember something similar, you were talking about this torture scene. There was another, I was like thinking to myself, fuck, where did I experience that before? And it was in Grand Theft Auto 5. Do you remember there was a quest, I don't want to go to the dentist anymore. When you're playing as Trevor, and he tortures this character, Ferdinand Kerimov. I don't just know this name off by heart. I have it in front of me.
Okay. No, cool. I was about to say, damn.
And that was also like, right? This guy can name drop. No. And that was also like an uncomfortable scene because you're torturing this guy. And a lot of the characters are like, no thanks, don't really want to be a part of this. And they start like walking out.
Oh yeah.
And I felt that kind of like turmoil, or at least that that feeling where I didn't really want to continue, but I do want to continue, you know, because you want to kind of like follow the logical progression of this character, even though it's taking you in places that feel uncomfortable. And I feel like that is a lot of the direction with which like Neil Druckmann took The Last of Us Part 2. And that's why, from what I've gathered from feedback from people who have played it, it's like an uncomfortable experience.
Yeah, I did not, you know, if you go like, I enjoyed the journey, but it's the same way as like you enjoy horror films or you enjoy thrillers. It's not like you got to be in a certain mindset and frame of mind. And I think particularly during this lockdown space, I don't know, I found myself far more sensitive towards the entertainment that I input into my brain. You know, almost in the past, I could like watch the scariest stuff and the, you know, most hardcore, you know, kind of like survival horror type games, you know, last thing before bed. And then like, cool, just put my head in the pillow and it's fine. I've definitely felt during this lockdown that I'm more sensitive towards what goes in. Like if I watch funny stuff, I feel better. If I watch horror and that sort of stuff, I feel more on edge. Whereas in the past, it's kind of like, yeah, it's just entertainment. I don't know why. Maybe there's some sort of study that explains what it is, but I mean, let's be honest, like this game dropped during lockdown. It's the end of the world based on a disease that spread throughout the planet without a cure. I mean, talk about freaking tones that people are gonna, you know, definitely take to heart. So I think the game affected people, like definitely. And it goes through some very, very heavy tones. I mean, we said we wouldn't talk much about it, but like it does hint on transsexuality. It does lesbianism, sacrifice and revenge and all that stuff. Like very heavy tones and very heavy themes, some of which are more or less pertinent now in 2020 than they've ever been. But I think the key thing for me is at what point do gamers go, I've been given a story to play my way through versus like I own these characters. You know, it's now the big ones that scream to mind are Mass Effect 3 and Game of Thrones season 8 as well, where people are like so angry they are demanding, like, you know, if they can't get what's his name and Co's blood, like, or head on a pike, then they want you know, a full rewrite or for them to declare like season 8 is non-canon, like almost a Dallas type. He woke up in a dream, like season 8 was just a dream, almost like Ned's head, instead of being removed in season 1, it turns out not only was he cake inside, but that it was all a dream. The next 7 seasons were all just a meat-induced dream. Like,
yeah. On that point, something that I've been kind of mulling over in the last couple of days, which builds on to what you said, is that when these games are kind of reaching a space where they're also, you know, leaning into what we would consider to be like cinematic, you know, blockbuster entertainment, right? Naughty Dog really kind of like pioneered that kind of like blockbuster video game feel, right? With like these big set pieces and like star characters, and feels like you're playing a movie. But we're getting to a point now where we're judging these games like based on how we judge movies, right?
Okay.
Like on actors' performances and writing. Like, I didn't like the twist, for instance, like that kind of turn that we're taking with it, where the game is more than just the set piece to set piece, or, you know, how act 3 differs from act 2, the line delivery, and, you know, it's a lot more than that. It's all the little intricacies in between that gets you moving from point A to B and gets you from, you know, this cutscene to that cutscene, that I think I haven't heard much dialogue around that. It seems like all the criticism of this game is coming from people being like, not my Ellie, not my Joel, not my Last of Us, you know, not canon, etc. And I feel like we're holding these games to like a different standard, and we're not actually looking at them as video games anymore. And that might just be because, you know, we're finding this merger, a blurring of the lines between these, you know, different forms of entertainment.
I think where gaming is going to struggle is the same way as kind of movies have, is going, not all, it's that line between art and entertainment, where you go, not all cinema and not all games are created equal. You know what I mean? It's like, and yet we have these high art moments in both cinema and games, and yet it's the same dollar price. You know, if you go watch the summer blockbuster, you know, obviously pre-lockdown days, the summer blockbuster, or the indie teen movie, or the, you know, award-winning kind of independent release, whatever, it's the same ticket price. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, in the back end are way different machines running, but at the point of consumption, it's the 100 Rand ticket price. And it's the same with games. So, you know, there's a quote I think you shared with them talking about, like, with all these games, you know, you've got all these games are in a world where all the games are John Wick, Last of Us stands out as like a Schindler's List. And you've got this weird concept here with the same thing with games. It's like, Last of Us exists in the same world as Fortnite, where like you collect zany guns and, you know, drink juice that gives you shields and build crazy forts. It's also a game. Then you've got like, you know, it's in the same genre as Call of Duty. It's in the same genre as Tetris. It's like, because it's games. And I think that you're getting to the point where you're starting to compare art with stuff that is just entertainment. And I think that's a space where maybe games aren't as mature as TV, because let's be honest, like there's almost this immediate separation when you know that like you're watching a TV show which is absolute popcorn, which is another one which is like high art and, you know, is meant to be film studied and torn apart and analyzed and all that. And I think gaming, unfortunately or fortunately, because it's got a greater amount of access points, because you can consume The Last of Us as a a person who just wants to play an action kind of, you know, a third person action game. It performs well enough. Graphics are good. Like, you might not even care for the story, but it performs well enough as that kind of game.
Yeah.
So, it is tough. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts as listeners. First and foremost, like, if you played Last of Us, what you thought, if it is a 10 or, you know, less, or did they ruin your Ellie, not your Joel, that sort of vibe. But I think more importantly, your thoughts on, like, are gamers too entitled? Do we feel we, like, own the game and that, you know, the directors and producers are beholden to, you know, us as the consumers to, you know, keep us happy? Yeah, as always, you can leave your thoughts on Twitter. We are at Guru_podcast. Sorry, we earned that underscore. We used to use it. Of course, Tim is at Tim and a Fish, and I'm at the Gareth Woods all on Twitter. But yeah, thanks as always for listening in. We love it, and the feedback really, really does help us. Any parting thoughts, Tim?
Parting thoughts. I just want to leave this Jason Schreier tweet here. In response to that Jeff Kanata tweet, which said that in a medium where everything is John Wick, Last of Us 2, Schindler's List, Jason Schreier, facetiously a Jewish games journalist, who released some really good reporting on Naughty Dog and sort of like the abuses that were going on within that workplace, responded to that tweet saying, see, Bioshock audio logs are a lot like the Diary of Anne Frank, which I thought was facetious, tongue-in-cheek, hilarious, and like right on brand.
And of course, we should be comparing Bioshock to the same, you know, the same literary levels of Anne Frank, which, I mean, reminds me of Ricky Gervais' joke where he goes, you know, read the Anne Frank's diary, ends a little bit abruptly. You know, it's like, you know, as far as books goes, like, I guess she didn't have time to pen a, you know, a magnum opus conclusion to her diary. But but yeah, jokes aside, thanks as always, guys, for listening in. Good fun talking with you, Tim. And yeah, rip.
As always.
See you guys next week. Cheers.
All right. Ciao.